It's my pleasure this evening to introduce our brother Johnny as our speaker, and I know that he appreciates your prayers and your kind attention as he brings us the message. Our brother Johnny.
Thank you, David. I believe I better dampen down a bit. I'm a little old to have my voice changing, but it seemed today that too often I open my mouth and I get a squeak. We sang this morning the song, Come Ye Apart. It's a little lengthy, when I look at a long song, I often try to sort out what we could get along just as well without and leave off a verse or two, but I couldn't do it with that one. However, what struck me the most profoundly does and has for a long time, and that's the lines that say, our vision fails, our sense of life's proportion, unless we seek the quiet place of prayer. It was kind of a shock to me when I discovered that there were really people who make a concerted effort to keep God out of their lives. And as I've had opportunity to watch some of them for some time, I can see that not only have they sought to eliminate God from their lives, they have got their lives out of kilter, just totally out of balance. And the proportion of life between all its myriad parts is scrambled. And when we think of the comfort and peace that we gain from the Lord from time to time, we can but lament at the number of people that have to live their lives without it. I admire President Abraham Lincoln to some considerable degree, and I often quote him to you or mention some bit of information that illustrates his faith. How at night when he was so troubled by his responsibilities and the fact that he was involved in a war not of his making, and it wasn't going well, that he would walk the streets of Washington at night, far into the night. Can you imagine a president doing that today? He can't do that today. And he couldn't do that then because there were those who had conspired numerous times to murder him, but his trust was in God, and he could do that. And he would also go to the Naval Observatory there and visit with the night operators who made the observations of time and temperature and all those things, and philosophize with them. But this piece of philosophy that I've saved in my book of quotes is, I don't know when he first voiced this, but it was concerning the Bible. It's truth, how valid its truths all are. And he said, take all of this book upon reason that you can, and the balance upon faith, and you will live and die a happier and better man. He knew full well that nobody fully understands the Bible. We encounter people who maintain that they do, and usually we decide from talking with them that they're pretty enthusiastic about not very much. So as he thought this over, he made a provision in his thoughts that we can take all of it on reason that we can grasp, that we see the true proportion of. And what is beyond our grasp counsels us that we should take the remainder on faith. I don't see how anybody could argue with that sort of philosophy. And I have tried very hard to live in that way and to take as much of it and increase the amount of it that I can take on understanding the reason. The language and the text of the Bible, I can't see that it is that difficult, but I have had so many people tell me that it throws them, that they can't handle it, that they can't make sense of it, and so they take the versions of it that don't make sense to me. But we have discovered that through our access to the Holy Ghost, which is not universally made, that we, over time and through our experiences, we're able usually to grasp a good deal more of the intents of the Bible than most of the people who regard themselves as sure enough Bible students. And yet, there's always plenty more. There's a great deal more for us to accept as true simply because that God is true and that we believe that he is always the same, that he doesn't change his mind, that he's not flighty like men are, that what he has said is as long-lasting as what he has done. Thinking along that line, it occurs to me also that to most of us, they're almost always, almost in every life, I should say, there comes a time when if we were talking to God, we would say, why did you create me? Why did I have to be born? If you knew that I was going to go through all the things that I go through, why? Think about Job. When he cursed the day that he was born, when he time and time again pled with the Lord to allow him to die. We really can't imagine, unless we've been there, what that would, what it takes to really feel that thought as if it were something that we should consider. And we don't know. We don't know Job's trials. We have some thin grasp of it, but we really don't know. But we do know somewhat of endurance, of somewhat of tribulation, some much more than others. And it seems on the surface that might be sort of a questioning of God's judgment when anyone would say, why did I have to be born to go through the things that have to be gone through? But I'd rather that we thought that it's more of an acknowledgement that I can't see. I can't see beyond what's happening in my life today to see the brightness, the joy, the peace, the fulfillment that the Lord has promised us is going to come. And now we probably even have somewhat of the idea that those brighter days are not so very far in the future. But we don't know. And we should be glad that we don't. I think we all agree that we are in the days that Paul described as perilous times, because he described the very things that we see people doing and hear of people doing all around us and all over the world, which is what makes it so very perilous. And Jesus' expression that he used, that in these latter days, or the last days, whatever he called it, that there would be a time of trouble such as there had never been before. Excuse me. But we live so nearly from day to day that the thought of men's hearts failing them for fear of the things that are coming upon the world still seems pretty foreign to us. And while we have some thin understanding of it, most of it gets away. And as I mentioned Job a little bit ago, and how vexed he was, though we don't really quite understand that, we do appreciate when we think of it how Job clung to his faith. That seems kind of like I've contradicted myself. Because of the times that he wished and pled God's permission to die, and yet to say that he clung to his faith. Let me read for you in chapter 19 of the book of Job. And I'm going to begin at verse 23. Oh, that my words were now written. Oh, that they were printed in a book, that they were graven with an iron pen and laid in the rock forever. For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. Does that sound to you like clinging to faith? It does to me. And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God, whom I shall see for myself, and mine eyes shall behold and not another, though my reins be consumed within me. That's faith. We have faith about many things, and I've spoken to you about my objection to people calling what I call confidence faith, because it's confidence in frailties of machinery and people. So I'm not going to hang on to that very long tonight. But the faith that makes a man certain that these things are true is almost an enviable faith, one that we can wish we had, one that we can strive for, something that is real enough in our imagination that we can work in that direction. He said, I know that my Redeemer lives. Why did he say that? Because he had experience with God, because God had spoken with him. And the unbeliever will say, well, anybody could speak to Job. The devil could speak to him, if there is one, but they usually say there isn't. But Job knew who had spoken to him. Not only that, but he had the testimony of the Holy Ghost in his life, along with his knowledge of the early scriptures, along with his knowledge of the commandments of God, all of those things, so that he was completely clothed in an understanding and a belief that couldn't be shaken. I'm certain that the Lord had not shown him what is beyond this mortal life, that he made this claim, if you would like to call it a claim, that even when there was nothing physical left of the body, yet in his flesh he said, "I shall see God." I used to wonder a lot about people whose lives are consumed in accidents, in fires, plane crashes, those who are buried at sea, where there is no physical material buried in the earth. And yet, if we believe in God, we also believe that he can resurrect a spiritual body, which is all that's required for us, a perfect body, one that doesn't have the frailties that we now have. I know I've told you this before, but one of the things that really impressed me when I was a small child in Sunday school, and usually then one of my older sisters would be my Sunday school teacher, and when we first became acquainted with Brother Alex Smith, he had already had the affliction that bent him in the middle of his back until he was bent over about 85 degrees, I'd say. And then it increased at the time that he was approaching death. The last time I saw him, walking with his cane again, which he had given up for many years, he could only see barely past his feet. And being told that in the resurrection, he would be able to stand tall again, that he would stand in a perfect body. That was so amazing to me, and it impressed me so much, especially since I believed it, that it has clung to me for all this time. Well, as Job testified that he knew these things, it was as though he knew them, because he believed God so wholeheartedly. We can almost compare him to Abraham for the faith that he had in believing God. And it also would be a faith, if I can go back again to President Lincoln, a faith such as his. And it came to him, as it did to Job, in hard lessons. Many hard lessons of life. He was a man who knew much sorrow and much difficulty, and so we can appreciate his counsel that we take the remainder upon faith. We remember from our early church history. I'm not departing completely, I hope, from that line of thought, but approaching it from a somewhat different angle. And we remember that when the angel took Joseph Smith to the place where the plates were buried and opened the box for him, he saw that there were a number of sets of plates. And as I recall, He was not allowed to touch or handle any at any time except the ones from which he interpreted the Book of Mormon by the power of the Holy Ghost. That there was a great deal more that had already been written and saved and was being protected by God and still is. And that's one of the wonders of God's power. And I've asked myself many times, I wonder when some more of these things are brought to light, if they're going to be found in the same place. And you know, it's kind of an idle thought because it doesn't make a particle of difference where they're being protected by God. The fact that men have moved every square inch of that mountain or hill many, many times over, seeking for the rest of those plates, they're not going to find them because they're hidden by God. If a man tries to find what man has hidden, he has a pretty good chance. But what God has put away and protected, we can be sure that it's safe from the curiosity of men. And I want to read a little concerning some of those plates. I want to read in the first chapter of Ether, and that'll be on page 714. Or will it be on 715? It'll be on 715. Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, 714. I was right the first time. I'll begin with verse 1. And now I, Moroni, proceed to give an account of those ancient inhabitants which were destroyed by the hand of the Lord upon the face of this north country. And I take mine account from the 24 plates which were found by the people of Limhi, which is called the Book of Ether. And as I suppose that the first part of this record, which speaketh concerning the creation of the world, and also of Adam, and an account from that time even to the great tower, and whatsoever things transpired among the children of men until that time is had among the Jews. Therefore I do not write those things which transpired from the days of Adam until that time. But they are had upon the plates, and whoso findeth them, the same will have power, that he may get the full account. But behold, I give not the full account, but a part of the account I give, from the tower down until they were destroyed. And on this wise do I give the account, and I'm not going to read any more of the account of Ether, but the assurance that Moroni had that these things would one day be in the hands of men, that someone would be given the power through God to deliver to men the entire message that is contained in those plates. As we read in the story, when we have read it, we know that these people brought with them, these people of Limhi had found these plates and brought them with them, and they couldn't read them. And they asked of the Nephites who found these people there where they lived, if there was in their society anybody who could translate languages, and they were told, yes, there is, that their king possessed a device which they called interpreters, and by the power of God could translate languages. And so they were delighted to find it out, and they got the story of ether. So we have what Moroni has given to us, and it's a part of those things, surely, that Joseph saw. And I'm so grateful that he was permitted to see that there are many more things that the Lord has withheld from men until this time. And it's one of the precious promises in my thinking that we have in the Book of Mormon, that these things will come forth. And we know the cautions that are given, that they will come in a time of faith. And it even suggests that it's possible that time of faith might not come. And I think we're going to find that in the 12th chapter of 3rd Nephi. And we're going to look on page 671 and see if I remember correctly what I was looking at when I wrote this down. Verse 1 of chapter 12. And now there cannot be written in this book even a hundredth part of the things which Jesus did truly teach unto the people. But behold, the plates of Nephi do contain the more part of the things which he taught the people. And these things have I written, which are a lesser part of the things which he taught the people. And I have written them to the intent that they may be brought again unto this people from the Gentiles, according to the words which Jesus hath spoken. And when they shall have received this, which is expedient, that they should have first to try their faith. And if it so be that they shall believe these things, then shall the greater things be made manifest unto them. And if it so be that they will not believe these things, then shall the greater things be withheld from them unto their condemnation. Behold, I was about to write them all which were engraven upon the plates of Nephi, but the Lord forbid it, saying, I will try the faith of my people. Therefore, I, Mormon, do write the things which have been commanded me of the Lord. adding this to the assurance that somebody is going to receive these things and translate them for us, we have this caution that it must be a time when the Lord's people believe wholly upon him. Obviously, we haven't reached that. We do our best. I'm satisfied that we do our best, that we strive and we beg the Lord to give us the increase of faith that we might be able to receive from him things that we need today, and also be found worthy at some later date that these other things, which certainly are valuable to us and would be valuable to all mankind if they could receive them, but we have no assurance that all mankind is going to receive them. In fact, we have the assurance they won't. But when our faith has been tried enough, when it has been exercised enough to have grown to that degree that the Lord expects, I think that we can suppose that time is going to come. While it says that if the people refuse, it won't come, yet the Lord did command that they be written and saved. The Lord doesn't do anything in vain. He doesn't create anything that is of no purpose. He doesn't say anything that has no meaning. So they will, at his time and with his favor, I cannot doubt that they will come to light, and that these things will be revealed to those who believe most steadfastly upon God. When that is, he only knows. And we only know that it will be because those whom we would like to call God's people will believe on him with a greater faith than they do today. There's a little more I'd like to read in about the plates, and it's in 1 Nephi chapter 2, and this will be on page 23. And I'm going to read, begin at verse 92. Nephi writing concerning the things that his father had taught them, had lectured them. I think probably over and over so that they would have them fully in their minds, even though some of his sons turned their minds away from those things. But he kind of picks up in the middle of his story here at verse 92. And all these things did my father see and hear and speak as he dwelt in a tent in the valley of Lemuel, and also a great many more things which cannot be written on these plates. And now as I have spoken concerning these plates, behold, they are not the plates upon which I make a full account of the history of my people. For the plates upon which I make a full account of my people I have given the name of Nephi. Wherefore they are called the plates of Nephi after mine own name, and these plates are also called the plates of Nephi. And so we speak of the large and small plates of Nephi. Wherefore they are called the plates of Nephi after mine own name. I'm repeating. Nevertheless, I have received a commandment of the Lord that I should make these plates for the special purpose that there should an account be engraven of the ministry of my people. And upon the other plates should be engraven an account of the reign of the kings and the wars and contentions of my people. Wherefore, these plates are for the most part of the ministry, and the other plates are for the more part of the reign of the kings and the wars and contentions. We really don't want to have to read of any more wars than we have on these small plates, do we? Wherefore, the Lord hath commanded me, and this I think is the keystone, the Lord hath commanded me to make these plates for a wise purpose in him, which purpose I know not. As faithful as Nephi was, and as many times as the Lord visited him in many ways, and spoke to him face to face many times, yet he said, why the Lord had me make these other plates, I do not know. And apparently he didn't belabor his mind with it either. He didn't wonder and doubt. He was just content that the Lord had commanded it, so it should be. But the Lord knoweth all things from the beginning. Wherefore, he prepareth a way to accomplish all his works among the children of men. For behold, he hath all power unto the fulfilling of all his words. And thus it is. Amen. I think I should mention that I'm not trying to school you on the various plates. I just wanted to make mention that there are several and take from the book what establishes that there are. Because I don't think there's any point in us trying to be experts and give names and to all of them and say, well, this covers that and this covers that and so forth. Because the Lord knows all those things and he'll bring them forth in his own time. And I haven't made any such study for myself because I see no particular point in it. But simply to know that they exist that they're in the Lord's care and that they will be brought by the Lord's power is not simply enough, but it's a sense, a source of a very considerable wonderment to me. I marvel that God has all these things taken care of in advance, so that we don't have to worry and say, "Oh, we're holding things up. We're dawdling between the shafts. We're not getting things done, and we're holding up the Lord's work." If we carry this line of thought a little farther to Joseph Smith, I think it might be well to think somewhat about the fact that he was chosen of God for God's own reasons. We know that he was a country bumpkin, that he was not educated, and that he was certainly not always wise. But that he was chosen of God to bring forth this book that we call the Book of Mormon, and that he was so chosen because God foreknew the deep and simple faith that this young man would possess. That he would go to God in the woods and taking the admonition that he received from the book of James and just expect that God would respond to him. He didn't go out there saying, well, why in with all of these people around here in this state of religious fervor and all of these educated preachers who think they know everything and apparently don't know much, why do I hope that I would understand from God himself what I want to know? Obviously, he didn't consider that. He just considered that James said, if any man lack wisdom, let him ask of God. So he did. And so he was a servant and he was a messenger. And he did do the work that was assigned him. We know that he trusted much too much in other men, that because of that, he did things that were foolhardy. But I'm also not here tonight to pick him apart. I think that would be a serious folly on my part. Excuse me. But my intent is to try to link all of these things that are precious to our souls, to put them all together, though loosely perhaps, and bring them back to one thing, and that is faith in God. As we think more of Joseph Smith, we know that many people have made in their imaginations much of Joseph Smith that he was not. And that's their problem. It's not a problem that I can solve for them. And even today, there are a great many people who regard him practically as God. And they do, in some considerable measure, worship the man. And the worship of the man we need to pick up and read from the book of the Revelation. As John was conversing with the heavenly messenger that came to him, the messenger told him a great many things, but there's one part of the interview that I think is extremely important to us, And that's in chapter 19 of the Revelation. And I'm going to begin to read at verse 9. And he said unto me, he saith unto me, write, blessed are they which are called in unto the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he saith unto me, these are the true sayings of God. And I fell at his feet to worship him. And he said unto me, see that thou do it not. I am thy fellow servant, and of thy brethren which that have the testimony of Jesus. Worship God, for the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy. I think that's so valuable to us. Even if a heavenly messenger comes to us, we're not to worship him, let alone a man who may speak to us by the power of God, yet he's still a man. And he must be regarded as still a man and not put our entire confidence and hope in him. And I privately go back to, excuse me, to this passage time and again that he was commanded to not get down on your knees to me, though he was directly sent to him from the presence of God. And my long-held opinion is that we don't need any more honorable title for ourselves than to be called brother or sister. I had an incident many years ago. I was a young man, and I don't claim that it was because I was quick on the uptake, because I'm not. I don't think fast on my feet. And there was a woman who frequently came to visit the old gentleman who lived down the road from us when we first lived where we do. He lived there a number of years. I think of him as an old man. I thought of him as an old man then, and I'm 10 years older than he was at this time. And this lady who came to visit him was kind of a colorful character, I guess. And she had brought some other friends with her, for the purpose of picking some grapes in the old man's grape vineyard. And I was there doing some other work for him, and I don't remember what it was. But I tried to help him out from time to time, so I was there. So she undertook to introduce me to these other people. And she called me the Reverend. And it caught me quite unawares. And, you know, I was not ready for that. But I said, oh, no, not Reverend. Why not? I said, we just don't call ourselves Reverend. Well, what do you want to be called? And I said, brother would be all right. And I stick to that. I cling to that kind of like a bear on the saddle blanket, but still I like the idea that we are brethren and sisters, that we don't have to speak of or to each other as though we were something far above the common, because none of us are. And beyond that, also, I would not be able to imagine a more welcome word than the Lord gives to us in the 25th chapter of Matthew, the one that I have to quote to you every once in a while. And that, of course, is concerning the time of our death and resurrection. And the Lord had asked of these people a great many things. And in this one parable that he used, he made this comment. And to me, the thought that this might be possible and that I might sometime hear this has been very precious to me many times when, particularly when I felt down and discouraged and distressed. Verse 22 of chapter 25. He also that had received 2 talents came and said, Lord, thou deliveredst unto me 2 talents. Behold, I have gained 2 other talents beside them. His Lord said unto him, well done, good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I'm going to drop it in the middle of the sentence because I think that's enough. That to me is enough to hope for. That is a wonderful thing to hope for, to hear the Lord actually say to us, thou hast been faithful over a few things.